Welcome to our Day 13 preview from the 2018 U.S. Open. I'm Ed Cohen with Rob Huba and Jane McManus. A special welcome to tennis fans around the world listening in on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. It's all set in the women's singles final Saturday afternoon in Queens, New York. Naomi Osaka in her third main draw at the U.S. Open, 20 years old. And Serena Williams, back as a mother, Jane McManus knocking on the door for a seventh U.S. Open title.
Oh, absolutely. What a terrific contrast in careers and length of careers so far to start. I mean, you have 72 career titles for Serena Williams. Naomi Osaka has one. I mean, I just love to think of, you know, someone who's like Osaka, who is such a, you know, a terrific young player, such an engaging personality as well, and who's got such a game to match it. She has played incredibly well, been pushed very hard, particularly by Sabalenka earlier in this U.S. Open, really met the challenge, down a set, and came back to win that match. And, you know, you look at the poise that she had also against Madison Keys, in the semifinal, her very first semifinal at a Grand Slam, and to be able to play as well as she did with the poise that she did, I think it bodes very well for her ability to play with Serena Williams in that final.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating. You know, you have Serena trying for number 24 to get to Margaret Court and tie that record. It'd be her first as a mom. The journey that she's been through, almost dying after giving birth, pulmonary embolism in the past, blood clots in the past. So she's talked about that. Then you have Osaka, who's really beginning the start of her tennis journey. And if Osaka is to win this, I wouldn't necessarily call it a changing of the guard, because that would imply that the person in Osaka could go on and do what Serena has done. That's not going to happen, because Serena definitely among the greatest tennis players who's ever played the game, men or women. But it would herald the beginning really of a new star. And Osaka has got a great personality. She's got a big game. She's worked on her game a lot. And she'll be buoyed by the fact that she beat Serena in Miami. But that was very early into Serena's comeback, after she was off 14 months, her second tournament back, and didn't have a great serving day that day. Serena, 5 double faults, only served at 53%. You know that's not going to happen. She's not going to serve at 53% tomorrow, I don't think. So she wants to get a lot of joy behind that first serve. But for the reasons that I touched upon, I think it's going to be such a compelling matchup. If she can handle the occasion and not be overtaken by nerves, I think it's going to be a very good final.
Her poise at the age of 20 has been really impressive in dropping just one set at the U.S. Open. And I guess the fear for someone like Osaka, will she overthink it? She says no.
I'm sure that everyone knows that Serena is really good, of course. But I don't know, like, I really feel like I don't want to overthink this match. So I'm not going to think that she's so much better than she was in Miami. I'm just going to go out there and play. And since I already know that she's a good player, I don't want to be surprised if she plays better or not.
Jane, what's impressed you most about someone who has just seemed so unfazed by every moment at this tournament? You can make the case that's been the way for Osaka in her prior trips here to Queens as well.
Well, I think she's her emotional maturity has definitely evolved in the last year. And that comes with wins, it comes with matches, it comes with being on the WTA Tour, and it also comes from turning from an 18-year-old into a 20-year-old. And, you know, as you know, that's a bit of a lifetime, you know, when you're at that age. So I think that's been great. But, you know, I'm very impressed with her game, obviously. Terrific forehand, a great serve, you know, has a lot of power on her shots. And that can throw off, you know, some players. And also, you know, it means you can play with Serena Williams. Not sure her return game is going to have to be terrific. But I think what I'm really looking for when they step onto the court is to see, you know, usually it takes Serena Williams about a game or two to really get going. But after that game or two, how is her serve? How is Serena Williams serving? Is she still at the level where she was in her semifinal match? And if she is, it's going to be very difficult to beat her.
Serena Williams is 36 years old. This is her first U.S. Open as a mother. She's trying to win here for the first time since 2014. It's been a long road back, but Serena says this apparently is just the beginning.
Honestly, it is remarkable, and I couldn't have predicted this at all. I Just been working really hard. And like I said, this is just the beginning of my return. I'm still on the way up. There's still much more that I plan on doing. You don't reach your best, you know, a couple months in, and that's kind of where I am now. So I just feel like there's a lot of growth to still go in my game, and that's actually the most exciting part.
Ravi, what's evident about Serena's game right now as she gets ready for this final?
What's evident is the fact that she's still trying to find her best game. As she's talked about, she's nowhere near the Serena that she was a few years ago, and that's only to be expected from her part. But I love the way she's talking and telling us that she's going to be around for a while longer. So even if she doesn't get to 24 tomorrow, I really do believe, and I mean it when I say that, I'm 100% convinced she'll get to 24 and she'll get to 25 and then take it from there, because she's a competitor. This is what's driving her. The fire in the belly is the term that she's used early in the tournament. She also said earlier in the event that maybe she thought that after giving birth, the competitiveness she has on a scale of 1 to 10, it had been 15 to 20. She thought maybe it would drop to a 10. Hasn't dropped to a 10. It's still 15 to 20. So that fire is still very much there. And you got to marvel at the competitor that Serena is.
And just to, you know, add a little bit to that, I mean, as someone who's actually given birth, to think of what she's been able to do, and she didn't just have a baby, she had a cesarean, which is a medical procedure, and it affects, you know, the muscles in your abdomen. And to be able to get where she is, her game is so dependent on her core strength, whether it's the serve or whether it's her ground strokes. And to be able to get where she is despite that, I think just speaks to her training and her competitiveness and what she is doing physically at age 36. Is amazing.
It's awesome. 17 seed Serena Williams vying for Grand Slam, as Ravi said, number 24. Osaka will be waiting. She was so impressive the first six matches of this tournament. Impressive in getting past Madison Keys in the semifinal. Should be a great one. Saturday afternoon at the U.S. Open. Also coming up on day 13, will the first time be the charm for Bethany Mattek-Sands and Jamie Murray in mixed doubles? In their debut tournament as partners, they take on Nikola Mektic and Alicia Rosolska for the title. And then on the outer courts here at the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, they've been busy all week with the U.S. Open Junior Tournament. Californian Jensen Brooksby advancing to the semifinals in boys singles. Top seed in the girls competition, American Coco Gauff, hopes to rebound from her quarterfinal loss today. She and Catherine McNally are the top seeded duo in doubles, and they are alive and well in the semifinals. And that is our day 13 preview for Ravi Uba and Jane McManus. I'm Ed Cohen. Thanks for listening. Join us for complete live coverage every day on U.S. Open Radio, presented by American Express. And you can find us on usopen.org or the U.S. Open app.
This year on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open, we're going behind the scenes talking to and about the personalities that make this tournament so great. Nick McCarville here along with you as the tournament starts to wrap up. One honor that the man sitting across from me had the last, well, several years in the past decade is chair umpiring the men's final. He did it in 2007, 9, 12, 13, 14, and just last year, Jake Garner, you're actually no longer, you're sitting in a chair right now, but you're no longer in the chair. You've stepped away from that life as it was.
Yes, I have. I made the decision at the early part of this year to step away. I have a great opportunity to work for the USTA in an administrative role in officiating. I'm now the senior manager of the professional pathway for officiating. So part of that is to help train and bring on the next generation of officials. And you know, I'm really excited about that opportunity. It was a tough decision to step away from a job that I love, but at the same time, I'm really excited about the next step and the new challenges.
Yeah, I want to talk about those challenges in just a second. I should make note that we're sitting just outside Arthur Ashe. There's planes overhead. Jack Sock nearby celebrating his doubles win. There's a lot going on as the men's semis are about to kick off this afternoon. But it's funny because I think for a lot of tennis fans, they see people like you on TV and they don't necessarily sort of fully encompass the life that goes along with being a chair umpire. What was the hard thing to step away from that job, and what maybe made the decision easy, or was kind of like, okay, this is definitely what I want to do now?
Yeah, so the hard thing is just, I mean, it's like I said, it's a job that I love. I love going to work each day, and it never was the same. You know, each match brought new challenges, and everything was different. I love the people that I work with. I love the excitement of the big matches. I love the excitement of being on site, being at the Grand Slams. So that's going to be the hard part. You know, I think come January when I'm not in Melbourne, that's going to be tough. But what made it a bit easier was, you know, being home a bit more. You know, I still love the travel, but I don't like being away from home. Two young daughters, a wife to you know, think about, and the idea that I'll be home a little bit more is certainly something that made it easier. But it's still going to be tough when, like I said, when those times come and I see my colleagues out there and you know, doing what they do the best and not being there to support them, because that's the thing that I'm going to miss as well, is being able to come off court and have friends there that know what I was going through during a match, support me, and not being able to give that back to them as well. That's going to be tough.
Yeah. How has it been? What's that dynamic been like this tournament?
It's different here because I'm still here. I'm still around. I'm still working with the officials, so I see everybody. I'm not sure it's different, but it's not the same as it's going to be when I'm just not there at all. So I'm still able to kind of have that interaction. We still talk about the matches. We still, you know, have that. And we'll still have it even when I'm not there. It just won't be as natural. The conversations won't be as free-flowing. It'll be more of an effort to do it. And, you know, and I know that in the end that, you know, those times will slowly go away, you know, and you know, that'll be tough as well. But I'm also, you know, I understand that, you know, the people that are there are going to be the ones who can offer the most advice and support. And, you know, and I served that role with my fellow officials for a long time, and that I'll miss, but they also will have some other people that they can, you know, rely on to give that information as well.
And Jake, has it been weird here waking up each day? And you're obviously at the US Open, you're in a new role that you've been in for a few months now, but to not be actually looking at the schedule each day and seeing which matches you're on?
Yeah, it's different. You know, I'm busy enough that sometimes it doesn't always sink in. You know, in an administrative role, we're busy. You know, I'm with the officials. I see them. You know, but sometimes we get to 1 or 2 o'clock, and I kind of have forgotten that tennis matches are being played.
Yeah.
In the sense, you know, to be as involved as I was before. I obviously know what's going on, and I know, you know, which courts are going long and things like that. But it's different. So, you know, like I said, I don't really think it's sunk in yet. And I haven't really processed it in the same way that I will when I'm not at an event.
So you mentioned your position, senior manager, professional pathway for officiating. Again, people will know so well the sight of a chair umpire on court, as well as the line umpires that work in shifts. But can you talk about this role and then sort of the greater community that the officials and officialdom has? Because it's not just as simple as, I think, you know, there's more to it, obviously, than might meet the eye.
Yeah, so, I mean, we see the officials here at the U.S. Open, and we don't realize that there's, you know, 49 other weeks of tennis that get played in the U.S. and over 90 pro circuit events that the USTA is in charge of signing the chair umpires for and developing new officials and bringing on the current officials so they can potentially reach higher levels. And so that'll be part of my role, to help with the training and bringing them on, working with the assignments to put the chair umpires specifically, but also line umpires, in the positions that is the best for them to succeed, and, you know, helping them achieve whatever goals that they want to. And we have officials who only really, as chair umpires, want to work on the pro circuits. And because we have so many events, we need those officials, but we also need them to be the best that they can be and the best that they want to be. But we also have officials that want to reach for higher goals, and, you know, we and I need to be there to, you know, help them with that, and that's, you know, that's the part that I'm really looking forward to, because, you know, I have a lot of experience that I can draw on, and yeah. And to be able to, you know, impart that on newer officials and officials who maybe don't have the experience that I have, I think will do great things for U.S. officiating.
Okay, so you mentioned the 49 weeks other weeks of the year of tennis in the U.S., the 90 pro circuit events. How big is that officiating operation? I mean, I'm guessing there's a lot of different pieces to that puzzle.
Yeah, so there's a few of us at the USTA that work specifically with those pro circuits. So we have somebody that does the assignments that I oversee. So I make sure that, again, that they make sense for what we need to do, but he's putting the puzzle together, and which is a hard job, you know, with 90 events and a lot of moving pieces. So that's part of it. And then also, you know, as we move past the U.S. Open, I'll be looking to travel to some of those events and do some coaching and some evaluation of the chair umpires and line umpires as well. So kind of those two parts come together with the pro circuits and bringing it along. And that is just a continuation of what we have as the community pathway. So I'm in charge of the professional pathway, but we have the community pathway as well. There's over 2,500 certified officials in the U.S.,
wow.
Most of them working at the community level, so junior events and adult events, things like that. And we're trying to set up, similar to the players have, a pathway that they can go along. They play the junior events, they play lower-level pro circuit events, and they work their way up. We're trying to do the same thing and really establish a clear way for officials to do that as well. So the community officials will come through with the education and training that we think is best, and we have a department that does the education and training specifically, so they're really focused on getting a consistent message out there so that officials that are trained all over the country come in with the same information, and then as those officials that show promise and interest want to achieve more, they can come through, and then, you know, the professional pathway might can kind of grab them a little bit and pull them through and continue the education and training through, and then, like I said before, just put them in the best places that they can to achieve what they want, and as well as providing the best officiating that we can to all of those events.
So there's always going to be a few people out there interested in getting involved themselves. Is that through their local section, or how does someone actually get started in officiating?
So yeah, I mean, they could reach out to their local section or district chairperson. They can always contact us at officiating@usta.com and get some information there. We'll point them in the right direction on where to go and who to get in touch with. We're always looking for new people that love the game and want to be a part of it, and at whatever level they can want to. Like I said, we have so many officials. Some only do it on the weekends when they have some free time, and some it's their full-time job.
Did I leave out a U.S. Open final, by the way? Six of them? Or
no, six is right. Six? Yeah, seven. Yep. Nope. Yep. All of those are right. So.
Okay. And then I didn't mention this. Australian Open men's final in 11, 15, 18. Wimbledon final 2010, 2016. And the Olympic final in 2008. That was pretty early in your career.
Yes,
somewhat.
It was. Yeah, that was early. It was unexpected. And to this day remains one of the highest honors to be, you know, to be on court when a gold medal is won, was truly amazing. And like I said, it's just one that I'll always just hang on to. It'll be a special moment.
Now, just by nature, officials, umpires, lines people, you guys are, you don't like accolades, but I'm going to embarrass you just a little bit here, because when I look at that list of what you accomplish in your career, in a lot of ways you could argue that you're one of the most successful Americans in pro tennis in the last 15 years, not obviously playing the sport, but I guess as you step away and you take on a different iteration of your career, what do you look back, what are you most proud of, and sort of how do you try to carry that into what you're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that also, in a way, made it easier to step away, is because I'm really proud of what I've done. A lot of effort went into it. It's not always easy, but to look back and to have been the chair umpire for some of those matches, and many of those that aren't listed there because they're not finals, but they're still, you know, amazing matches. It's part of tennis history. And to be a part of that and on the biggest stages, I'll always be able to hang on to. And there's too many matches and situations that I could to sit here and list, you know, what the ones that I'll look back on. But what I think about the most sometimes is I've been lucky enough in doing some of these finals to have family members there with me and being able to watch the match in person and knowing that they're the ones who offered the support from the beginning. So I've been lucky enough to have my parents at a final, my wife and daughter at a final, or one of my daughters at a final, my sister at a final, and her husband. So it's great that you can kind of share that moment with them, because they're part of the reason that I was able to do it, with the support that they gave. And you know, of course, I'll remember the tennis, but it's the people that are around it that sometimes, you know, stand out more.
Well, a hearty congratulations from courtside, from everyone listening to you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. as we continue our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open. Our guest on this podcast was inducted at the International Tennis Hall of Fame in July of 2017 and honored for a sterling career as the best American men's tennis player of his generation. Andy Roddick is, in fact, the last American man to win a Grand Slam singles title, realizing that extraordinary feat in 2003 with a popular victory at the U.S. Open when he was only 21. But that was not Andy's only substantial accomplishment. He finished 2003 as the number one ranked player in the world, no mean feat when you consider that his closest rival was none other than Roger Federer. He also spent 9 consecutive years, from 2002 through 2010, among the top 10 in the world. Moreover, Andy was instrumental in leading the United States to victory in the Davis Cup in 2007. His career concluded fittingly at the 2012 U.S. Open. Through it all, he was an unflagging competitor and a top-of-the-line professional. Andy, thanks for joining me on this podcast as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Open Tennis and the U.S. Open.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to be on with you, Steve.
Let's move on with that 2003 Open. So after the Ljubicic match, you really kind of marched on to the semis. So you got on a roll and you were beating everybody in straight sets. And then you found yourself down 2 sets to David Nalbandian. Talk about that one, because eventually you had to save a match point in that third set tiebreak with a 138-mile-an-hour bomb of a serve, and you came all the way back to win it. But talk about what he was throwing at you that day and why it was so tough to beat him.
Well, it was a little bit weird. I remember, I think I beat Malisse in the round of 16 and then Shalkin in the quarters, but there was a lot of time between those two matches just because of weather. And it became kind of a screwy tournament. And I think I actually played Friday, Saturday, Sunday to win the tournament. And
yeah, you know, tough way to do it.
I got into it and I just played a ton of tennis, and David just kind of had me a little bit of a sleeper hold. I felt like I should have won the first set. I felt like I was the better player. Didn't really capitalize. It was kind of completely backwards to the way my entire summer had gone. And then all of a sudden he broke me out of nowhere in the second. And I'm going, oh my gosh, like this is a nightmare. Just tried to hang on, and maybe it was a lesson learned from the previous 2 years that we had talked about. You know, against Pete, I'd certainly let it get away from me, and he just ran right through me. And, you know, Nalbandian, that probably could have easily been a straight set win for him. I kind of just toughed it out and got through that third set breaker, and then the momentum shifted very quickly. I don't know if he was pretty tired. He might have had to play Thursday and Friday. I definitely felt like my legs had more in them than his did. We get to the fifth set, and you know, he gets a call that probably wasn't great for him to break serve. You know, at that point, I feel like I had control of the match, but that doesn't necessarily always equate to winning. There is an element of timing and, you know, opportunity and a lot of other things that go into match as opposed to just feeling like you're the better player. So,
and this time, of course, you certainly had the crowd fervently behind
yes.
you in this case as the American. I mean, how much of a role do you think they played in sort of igniting you and getting your adrenaline?
Well, it was huge, and I think they liked me just fine at that point. I think they were still trying to make their mind up about what they thought about me.
Yeah.
But I think an undersold factor of the crowd really getting behind me in that Nalbandian match is that Andre had lost. So I was
yes,
the last
he'd
player.
Lost to Ferrero, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. So I was the only hope. So for better or worse, they had to get behind me. So I definitely used him and got through. And then it's, you know, that match finishes, and it's, you know, I don't think maybe people don't realize, like, you have blisters on your feet, you've been playing, you play 5 sets, and as soon as you're done, it's going, oh my gosh, I have to put myself together again. And I don't know what time he finished. It had to be 7 or 8 at night, and the finals at 4 the next day. It's like, okay, you got to figure out food, you got to figure out treatment, you got to figure out how this is all going to fit into the jigsaw puzzle so that you can get enough sleep. All the while, you're trying to think of, hey, I hope I can sleep because I'm so excited about tomorrow. And oh, by the way, you're playing the guy that has just beaten Andre and will be the number one player in the world the next Monday. So it's a bit of a whirlwind. You know, kind of turning it around from Super Saturday to Sunday.
So how did you manage it? I mean,
the thing I'm about to tell you, I think it was a blessing in disguise. There was so much happening, and it was so there. You, there was no idle time to sit around and think about what was going on. I knew I had form. I knew I was, you know, in really great shape. I knew I was in match shape. I had been playing matches, you know, for the last 2.5 months, pretty much every other day or every day, except for, you know, I might have taken a week or two off. So I knew I had form. I wasn't going to go out and lay an egg with form. I knew the nerves wouldn't affect me like that. I knew my serve would get me through tense moments. You know, so, and then it all went so fast that I all of a sudden it's, you know, 3:40 before 4 o'clock start. And I think that's when it hits me. I'm going, oh my gosh, this is like, it's a US Open final. And I'm the guy walking out of the tunnel. I've been watching this match for 15 years already. So,
was that kind of surreal then?
Yeah, I think that's when it kind of got, I was really loose. I was, you know, I think Brad and I were doing bratting practice during warmups, and it was all pretty kind of, pretty loose. And then there were two moments I got nervous where we're walking off the practice court and Brad kind of gave me a fist bump and he goes, impose your will on this guy. And I'm like, oh God, okay, I'm about to go do this. and then right before, you know, when they have the live feed going and you see, you know, for me, they drape the American flag over the court and they kind of go through the whole thing. And it all was very patriotic. And I'm going, oh man, this is on me.
Well, you certainly responded, Andy. I mean, straight sets, 3-6 and 3, and second set obviously was the pivotal one. But what did you think was the key to your beating the man who had just handled Agassi the day before? And Ferrero had demonstrated against Agassi that he certainly was a formidable hard court player. So what was the difference?
Tennis is all matchups. I mean, you get to a certain level and everyone can, you know, you get to the top of the game and everyone is capable of beating anyone, correct? And it becomes matchups, and I don't think I gave Juan Carlos any rhythm. I think he would have rather played Andre, and Andre, you know, obviously was a better player than I ever was. But in the match against Andre, he got to get in and hit balls, and I don't know what I served. I think I served 30 some aces that day, or 20 some. I just remember thinking this guy can't even touch my serve. He's not even getting into return games, and so that kind of freed me up. In the first couple games,
did that surprise you, Andy? He's a great returner. No.
No, because he's a great returner, but he likes time. You know, Andre was a great returner, but he was happy with the ball coming quick to him. You know, he was a timing returner, where JCF kind of, I guess, felt his returns a little bit more. I came out in the first couple ground strokes I hit were crisp. I hit a winner. I hit a forehand, I remember, early in the – it was an inside-in forehand that I kind of just stepped into and kind of took – on the short hop, and it just came off clean. I don't know that I was trying to hit a winner, and it ended up by him, no problem. I'm going, all right, I got something today. And so I felt like I was in control of that the whole time. And even my nerves were, I was almost catatonic. Like, I was just kind of cruising through, and I didn't actually use the crowd that much that day because I didn't want anything to change from the way it started. You know, it's weird. There's no need to use the crowd if everything's going perfectly.
So, yeah.
So I didn't. And then when he double faulted, and I actually felt that he was going to double fault at that point, and part of me was hoping he was going to double fault, but it was a 3-4 in the third set. And then all of a sudden, I'm really glad I didn't have a switch over to think about serving the match out. You know, he double faults. I'm a little nervous. The first serve, there's an ace, and then it's just rolling from there. You know, there's a huge difference when you're trying to serve it out between 15 love and love 15, especially on the as far as your emotions go. So
might have been a different feeling if it had gone to 4-all and you break for 5-4 and you have to sit at the changeover, right?
Oh yeah, you know, the thing that's fascinating about tennis, and I don't need to tell you because you're the human encyclopedia, but you know, it's being alone with your thoughts is one of the most fascinating things about tennis, and the way that different players, and I'm probably a little more honest about the way that I digested my thoughts than most are, but it's all different. It's also fascinating, and I'm glad, you know, you turn around Saturday to Sunday. I didn't have time to sit and think, and I didn't have time to sit and think before I went and served the match out, and you know, it went pretty cleanly.
So, Andy, I remember you being in joyful tears when it was over. But when you had the time to reflect, it's an odd thing for me to say, I guess, but didn't you feel you deserved it? I mean, you really had been through this stretch from Queens right through the Open, winning 5 out of 7 tournaments. You really had been the best player in the world. And you'd even beaten Roger in that phase in Canada. Mm-hmm. come back from 2-4 down the third to beat him. I mean, didn't it dawn on you that you really had earned it?
Yeah, I thought so. I look back at in even when I was ranked number one, I don't know that I thought I was better than Roger, but I think you're right. That summer for that, you know, 2.5 month stretch or whatever it was, I think that's the time where I was the best player in the world.
How do you feel about the connection you have with the Open and the prominence that you achieved there and what an important part of your career, the U.S. Open, how the U.S. Open fit into the context of your career?
Well, I mean, it goes without saying that the U.S. Open was way more important to me than I ever was to it. You know, and that probably goes for any player, but, you know, to win it, I went to my first U.S. Open in 1991. My mom took me up there as a birthday present. So we went and I snuck into every match of Jimmy's, for that entire run. And you leave that and you're just like, man, I'd watched tennis on TV, but I think it took my fandom to another level. You know, so I'm the kid who was sneaking into the matches. And then 12 years later, I was the guy winning the tournament. I don't know what words I can say to, you know, express how thankful I am for that tournament, whether I was a fan, whether I was a winner. I lost first round and I was the guy that was, you know, spoiled the party. You know, so I've had every emotion at that tournament. And so it's such a, I'm always obviously going to be referenced with it. It's part of my history and I'm thankful for it.
Well, Andy, I knew this discussion today was going to be a lot of fun, but it's exceeded my expectations. I really appreciate all of your reflections on your career and having this chance to talk about it with you in depth. So thanks so much.
Well, I was looking forward to it. I know it was probably my doing, but we didn't talk too much during my career. You know, so I'm having spent the weekend we spent last year in Newport, I'm glad we kind of finally got around to doing this.
Oh, it was great, Andy. It was terrific. Let's do it again sometime in the future.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Steve.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.